All right, we're doing a sound check. One, two, three. One, two, three. Tell me a little story.
Do I have to do it in a British accent? Right. I've already given you enough stories.
That's fair. Welcome to Crime Suit Podcast. I'm your host, Kaylee Carter.
And I'm Hannah.
And this week we'll be discussing the mysterious disappearance of two young boys from Harlem, New York. This is the story of Christopher Dansby and Shane Walker. Before we dive into the mysterious disappearances of Christopher Dansby and Shane Walker, it's important to set the stage. The crimes we'll be discussing today took place in 1980s Harlem, New York. Harlem is a very specific neighborhood in Manhattan, New York, just north of Central Park, and consists of 1.5 square miles of dense urban businesses and apartment buildings. The years between 1910 and 1930 marked what was called the Great Migration of African Americans, when approximately 6 million African Americans left the South to escape the harsh racial discrimination of Jim Crow laws, which resulted in a massive influx of Black residents into urban areas like Harlem, New York. While only 10% of Harlem residents in 1910 were Black, by 1950 it was 98%. Despite New York being considered a refuge state for Black Americans fleeing the South, racial discrimination was still rife. In order to discourage Black tenants from renting their apartments, landlords would commonly charge significantly more if you were Black, sometimes as much as triple the cost. Landlords weren't being monitored. They were charging outrageous prices, discriminating against non-whites, and also wouldn't invest in their housing units, letting them fall into disrepair because they knew Black residents had so few alternative options and would continue to pay. In 1937, the federal government constructed the first ever housing project, called the Harlem River Houses, subsidized housing that finally allowed lower-income individuals and families to afford a place to live. Tens of thousands of these units were constructed over the next 20 years, and it made it harder for landlords to exploit Black residents anymore. All of the buildings that had gone into disrepair were no longer being inhabited, and Harlem's population was shrinking. By 1987, 65% of Harlem's buildings were owned by the city of New York, many of which were just sitting empty. And this is where we find ourselves when in May of 1989, a young Black single mother of two living in the Martin Luther King Jr. Towers housing project in South Harlem took her two small sons, aged 3 and 2, to play at the playground in her complex. The Martin Luther King Jr. Towers is a large complex of 10 apartment buildings with over 1,800 units, several basketball courts, and a playground right off of Malcolm X Boulevard, just 2 blocks north of the Harlem Mir, a man-made reservoir on Central Park's north end. May 18, 1989 was a hot day in New York City, partly cloudy with a high of 85 degrees. Allison Dansby was a single mother of two young boys, LaVon, 3 years old, and Christopher, 2 years old, and lived in one of the apartment buildings at the Martin Luther King Jr. Towers complex, more specifically the building at 41 West 112th Street. On this particular sunny day, Allison met up with her mother, Elizabeth, her two sisters, Addie and Carolyn, and a cousin at the Martin Luther King Jr. playground located by their complex, just a short walk from her building. Unlike a lot of playgrounds within apartment complexes, the Martin Luther King Jr. playground isn't actually nestled between the buildings. This particular playground sits at the far end of the complex, with an easy public access and a busy road just outside its fence. Since this was the only public playground in the immediate area, it's safe to assume other neighboring families were also using the park too, not just residents of the towers. After getting her two boys ready to play about 6 p.m., Allison walked them down to the playground, which was bustling with other children enjoying the nice weather and getting their energy out after a long day of school, while parents and guardians sat on the benches to chat. Seeing that the playground was full of other kids and her two sons were enjoying themselves, Allison decided it would be the perfect opportunity to step out and get some groceries while her boys were entertained. She thought about taking her youngest son, Christopher, with her to the store, but realized she hadn't brought his stroller with her to the park. Instead of going all the way back to her apartment to get his stroller, her mother assured her she could watch the boys until Allison got back from the store, which should only take about 30 minutes. When Allison returned to the playground a little after 7 p.m. after getting groceries, she looked around and asked her mother, "Where's Christopher?" This is when everyone first noticed that Christopher wasn't anywhere in the playground. According to Allison's mother, Elizabeth Manley, who had been watching Christopher and LaVon play that evening, she last saw Christopher playing ball with his 7-year-old cousin, Elton, near a public bathroom at approximately 7 p.m. Elizabeth later tells police that she was speaking with a friend at the time and had only turned away from Christopher for no longer than 5 to 10 minutes. After anxiously searching the entire block, Allison called the police to report her son missing. According to Captain Michael Fusito of the Housing Authority Police, officers canvassed the entire 10-building King Tower complex as soon as possible, going door to door asking if anyone had seen Christopher, but it turned up no leads. The following day, Friday, May 19th, more than 70 City and Housing Authority police officers expanded their search to another housing project across the street called the Taft Houses, and scuba divers searched the Harlem Mir, the shallow reservoir at the north end of Central Park, just a couple of blocks away. Custodial workers at King Towers raked through dumpsters and bloodhounds were given articles of Christopher's clothing to sniff. Police were out looking for the missing toddler in full force, even using helicopters. But nothing came of the police's search. One bloodhound was able to track Christopher's scent headed south down Lenox Avenue to 110th Street, but then it disappeared. The Harlem Mir pond turned up empty. Neighbors didn't see anyone or anything suspicious. A 7-year-old boy from Christopher's neighborhood later told police that he saw Christopher walking on West 111th Street later that day. He was accompanied by a black male. However, police were never able to determine who the man was. And then, the day after Christopher disappeared, his cousin reportedly saw him walking with a man near the cousin's school. The man had Christopher by the hand. Christopher was wearing the same clothes he had on the day before. His cousin went to the principal to report what he had seen. Police were called. However, no trace of Christopher or the man was found. An unknown man spotted near the playground around the time of Christopher's disappearance was a person of interest until he was eventually located, interviewed, and cleared of any connection to the crime. Christopher's story and picture were circulated in the local newspapers for a few days after his disappearance, then a couple more times the following month, asking readers to contact police with any information, but his case ran cold very quickly without any evidence or eyewitnesses. It felt like Christopher Dansby vanished into thin air. Nobody saw him taken and nobody heard him scream. One second he was there, happily playing, and the next second he was gone. Some people speculated that Christopher's 26-year-old mother, Allison Dansby, was responsible for her son's disappearance because she had a history of using crack cocaine and probably sold him to pay a debt. Allison and her family all denied these accusations and stated that she was actually in recovery from drug usage and didn't owe anyone any money. Christopher's father, Milton Westcott Robbins, was living and working in Miami, Florida as an aircraft mechanic when his son disappeared. He returned to Harlem after Christopher went missing and their 3-year-old son, LaVon, moved in with him. Police confirmed that Allison Dansby and her family took polygraph tests, but the results were inconclusive. Christopher's case was an anomaly when compared to other missing children's cases in New York City at the time. Each year, the city searched for about 8,000 missing children under 18, but most were runaways who eventually were located. Christopher Dansby was one of only 8 children in the last decade under the age of 10 who remained missing and were believed to be abducted by a stranger in New York City. Let me say that again. There were only 8 children under the age of 10 believed to be abducted by strangers between 1979 and 1989 in New York City who were never found, and Christopher Dansby was one of them. And of those 8 children who went missing and were never found, there was only one other 2-year-old. You might be thinking, so what? But what if I told you that this other missing 2-year-old was also a little black boy being raised by a single mother in Harlem at the Martin Luther King Jr. Tower Apartments, last seen playing at the same playground, just 3 months after Christopher disappeared? Have I piqued your interest? Just like Allison Dansby, there was another single mother living in Building 41 of the King Towers Apartments in 1989, only 2 floors above her, named Rosalie Glover. Allison and Rosalie knew of each other, but they weren't necessarily friends. Apparently, a decade before, Rosalie's niece had a falling out with Allison's sister, and the rift was over a guy, but nothing more. Rosalie didn't think she was able to have children, but miraculously became pregnant in her 30s in 1987 with a little boy. She named him Shane, after one of her favorite Western movies. At 5 o'clock in the evening, Thursday, August 10th, 1989, 19-month-old Shane Walker sat on a bench with his mother at the King Tower Playground, the same playground where Christopher Dansby disappeared only 3 months earlier, eating strawberry ice cream, when 2 older kids, a 10-year-old girl named Crystal and her 5-year-old brother named Kevin, asked Rosalie if they could play with Shane. Rosalie hesitated. She was very protective of Shane, and he was still very young to be playing with bigger kids, but the 2 kids begged her to play with him. She knew that they lived in the complex, so she finally relented. As she sat on the park bench watching her son play, an elderly man with a crippled arm she had never seen or met before came up to her and just started talking. He started talking about crime, how things just happen to children, and he even mentioned kidnapping. She turned to look at him, but when she turned back, Shane and the 2 older kids were gone. At first, Rosalie didn't panic because she assumed the kids had all gone somewhere together. But when she found the brother and sister alone, they told her that they'd just left Shane on the playground. Rosalie immediately went to Harlem's 29th Precinct Station House to report Shane missing. Within hours, they had helicopters flying over the neighborhood. Police sweeped a 50-square-block area without turning up a single clue or suspects. Every building and lot from 110th Street to 123rd and Madison Avenue to 8 was searched at least once, with parts of Central Park searched repeatedly. Every tip from the hotline was checked, but nothing brought police any closer to finding Shane or Christopher. Cops checked out possible drug-related motives, child sacrifice cults, and child theft rings. They searched all 1,800 apartments at King Towers 3 times. They led a dog that can sniff out cadavers through the sewers and dozens of abandoned buildings. They checked out 500 reported sightings with law enforcement agencies in every state and Canada. And they literally demolished a crack house at 113th Street and Lenox Avenue, where a caller said they'd find one boy. Cops traveled to Puerto Rico, St. Croix, and St. Thomas, where there were leads pointing to a cult that had possibly taken the boys for sacrifice. A psychic told police that the boys were within a 1 mile radius of the playground. Rosalie even went on the Geraldo show, where a different psychic told her that Shane had been abducted by a Hispanic man who drove him in a station wagon to Philadelphia and was sold to a loving family who taught him to play the piano. Police's official profile of the perpetrator was either a male sex offender who operated in the area or a female drug addict whose child had died or was taken by child welfare. They investigated 200 known pedophiles, child molesters, and sex offenders in the area. In January of 1991, police actually received a call about a child's body that matched Christopher Dansby's size and age, dumped in the woods 30 miles outside of Atlantic City, but the footprints didn't match. In the end, there was nothing to even definitively say a crime had been committed. If Christopher and Shane were kidnapped, there was no demand for money and no witnesses of their abduction. Shane's father, James Edward Walker, was a construction worker that lived 10 minutes away who would drop by to see Rosalie and Shane every Thursday, a payday, to give them money. He kept Shane's missing person card taped to his car window. Police confirmed he took a polygraph test, but his results were also inconclusive. I don't have, like, a legitimate theory. This is like, dumbfounding to listen to. I do think they were kidnapped. I don't know if it was by, like, a sex trafficker or a pedophile or just, like, a murderer. I have no idea. I cannot fathom this at all.
I think the most, like, upsetting part is that there's just nothing. Like, there is no real physical evidence. Like, nobody saw the boys being stolen, right?
Yeah.
There isn't actually any evidence of a crime. Like, it's almost like the boys completely disappeared into thin air and, like, nobody heard them scream. Nobody saw them get taken. Nobody, you know, you have, like, only a couple of eyewitnesses from elementary age children saying that they saw the boys later that day and the next day with some strange men. But those never went anywhere.
Yeah, there's literally nothing. I just don't understand.
How? Do you think it was, like, do you think that the cops just missed something or that they failed in some way? Or do you think that the supposed kidnappers were actually just really, really good at their job?
One thing that I wanted to look into that I totally forgot until just this moment was I wanted to look into what other kidnappings had been around the area. Like, were there kidnappings in different parts of New York, like on the same day or in that same time period?
Everything was recorded. So if you look at the statistics.
Oh, that's right. Because you said that there were only
eight. They have everything recorded. Like, remember, there was only 8 kids in a span of 10 years.
That hadn't been found.
That were never found under the age of 10. And these two boys were 2 of those. And then some people link Christopher and Shane's case to another little black boy who was assumed to be kidnapped across town. But I don't know how well linked they are because the other little boy was an infant and his mother was found killed. So somebody killed his mom and took him.
Yeah.
Andre Bryant. With Shane and Christopher, it's just so obvious all of the similarities, like the same day of the week. They were roughly the same age, same broad demographic, right? Like both being raised by single mothers at the same apartment complex. And also, so they were both kidnapped on a Thursday evening, which seems like it might be significant that it was the same perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that means that since they were kidnapped in the evening, if whoever did it had like a day job.
Did Rosalie and
Allison?
Yeah. Did Allison and Rosalie often take their kids to the park like the same day of the week?
I don't know. I assume just like most parents, there's certain times that you're more likely to go regularly.
Yeah.
Like in the evenings, or some parents will just take their kids first thing in the morning when the weather is cool. They're actually going like during the hottest part of the day. So as a parent, when I was reading through these stories, it made absolute sense to me, though, because I do the same thing that I think Rosalie and Allison were doing, which is I take my kids to the park right before bedtime.
Mm-hmm.
And so like 6 o'clock, between like 5 and 7 when they both went, is the same time that like Nathaniel and I will often take our kids to the park, because we
want to tire them out.
We already don't get very good sleep, and the kids will sleep better if you just completely run them ragged.
Yep.
So you take them to the park, you have them just like sprint around and play hard for, you know, an hour or so, and then they tend to sleep better. And especially if Rosalie and Allison aren't getting any other help, like they're single mothers.
Yeah.
Like they want their kids to be as tired as possible before they go to bed.
Yeah, and they
those
worked.
Women are also probably very tired.
Yeah. They had full-time jobs and everything. This just absolutely blows my mind, honestly, that nobody saw anything. The kids didn't cry. I mean, the kids were little enough to probably, like, just be starting their, like, stranger danger stage, so maybe not throw a fit.
Both moms, I think, at different points said that they didn't think that their sons wouldn't have put up a fuss, that they were both kind of clingy.
Yeah.
Especially Shane. Mm-hmm. Rosalie kept saying over and over again that Shane was very timid of strangers and was very clingy with his mom. And she was like, there's absolutely no way that he wouldn't have been crying or screaming. And so that's a whole other piece of the puzzle that I don't have an explanation for,
yeah.
Which is like, how did they keep the kids from crying or screaming? One explanation is that they were taken by somebody that they know.
Mm-hmm.
But according to the police and the news outlets, all of the family members were interviewed and polygraphed, which we know isn't really that
reliable. It's buck science, yeah.
Yeah. And literally everyone came back inconclusive.
I think everyone's like, always going to come back inconclusive when the stakes are that high. Like, because
we should, you know what we should do, Kaylee, is we should sign up for a polygraph examination.
Oh my God, that's a good idea.
And we should see how we do.
I would fail because I have a lot of internalized guilt. About just everything in general.
They'd ask you if you murdered someone, you'd be like,
I don't know, I don't remember. Have I?
Maybe.
Maybe I've like metaphorically murdered someone, I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing about polygraph examinations is that you take these people who have just recently been very traumatized and probably have a lot of, like in this case, it'd be like mom guilt.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't do enough to protect my child.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they're asked, like, did you have anything to do with your child's disappearance, inside you might be thinking, like, well,
probably, I mean, because I wasn't watching them.
I looked
and, yeah.
away for too long, yep. And maybe that's why he's gone, and really, I'm the guilty person in this. And it's like, no, you're not.
Yeah, no. But of course, they have guilty consciences because they're parents. But, okay, especially, did we talk about, did Rosalie have a polygraph test that was reported? Because I know we talked about a little bit earlier, Allison had a polygraph test that came back inconclusive.
I think everyone's was inconclusive.
Okay.
All of the ones that I read about, like both of the dads came back inconclusive. And Shane's dad, I thought, was really cool. He took his son's like missing person card that he was given with his son's picture, mm-hmm. and information and stuff, and he taped it to the inside of his car window.
Aww.
So that whenever he would, because he lived, you know, like I think 10 minutes. It's down the road.
Yeah.
And he was a construction worker. So anytime he would drive around town, he had his son's little picture in his window so people could see it, which doesn't seem like something you would do if you were guilty.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I honestly don't think any of them did it. Like I was watching some interviews after this, and the interview that I specifically most recently watched was taken in 2014. And Rosalie had like little pictures of what her son would look like now, or I guess at the time in 2014. And they both were just distraught. And I, listening to them speak, I don't think that either of them did it or could have done it.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I didn't, for the sake of the episode, I didn't watch or listen to any outside sources besides like the newspaper articles from the time, for mm-hmm. the most part, because I think Netflix did a new special on it. I know the women have done more recent interviews, but so if I listen to those, I'm sure that it would probably affect my feelings about it.
Yeah.
But one thing that really stood out to me is that Alliston and Rosalie reacted very differently, it seemed, according to the news, like, obviously.
Yeah.
And the news is biased, and so the way that the women are sometimes portrayed may have hints of, like, bias in it. But in one of the newspapers, specifically the Daily News, that was published October 13th, 1991, a reporter asked Christopher's mom, Alliston, about, and this, so 1991, this is like a year and a half or 2 years after Christopher goes missing. They asked her, like, about her son's belongings, because I think they were interviewing her at her apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And she was quoted as saying, his clothes, I must have thrown most of that junk out. There's nothing here of his. He ain't here. It's too late to blame anybody. Ain't going to bring him back. And I just remember reading that, and I know everyone reacts to grief very differently. And so I'm not necessarily saying that what she said is wrong, but it did kind of strike me as odd, because, like, I have a hard time with my own kids, because I have a kid who's about the same age that Christopher was, around the same age that her sons were. And, like, I have a hard time getting rid of their clothes after they've already outgrown them. And my kids haven't been kidnapped, or they haven't disappeared, or had anything tragic happen to them. Like, being a mom myself, there's a lot of sentimentality in a lot of your kids' belongings. And so it just kind of struck me as odd, because I don't know that I would have reacted the same way as her. I think it would have been really, really hard for me to get rid of my children's stuff if I was still holding out hope that they were still alive and that I was going to get them back. And so just her use of the word junk, like referring to his clothing as junk that she threw out, it kind of rubbed me the wrong way. But I might be reading too much into it.
Okay, so I have some thoughts about that, though, because we know that Alliston struggled with drug usage, and that was probably something that affected the way that she felt. Like, so we know that she was struggling with using crack, and it was probably something that affected the way she parented, and she probably had a lot of guilt about that, and I'm sure she started using a little bit after as well, after her son went missing, because who wouldn't spiral after something terrible like that happened? So feeling like your own actions played a part, especially when it comes to drugs, playing a part into the reason your son vanished, even if that's not true, even if it's not totally true, just because she was on crack doesn't mean her son was destined to be kidnapped, right?
Mm-hmm.
But she probably had a lot of guilt about that. And having to see her son's things, having to be reminded every day of how terrible of a mother she is, in quotations, right? Because I'm sure that's something that she felt over and over. That reminder would be just soul eating. I imagine she would have to put some of her son's stuff away or react in that way out of self-preservation, just because that's so fucking awful to feel that way all the time. So I'm giving her the benefit of the doubt in that sense, because I might react in a similar way if I had been in her shoes.
Yeah. No. So, yeah, there's definitely, and I'm not saying it's one way or another.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, like, yeah, people react differently to death and to grief. Like, when somebody dies, one person's reaction might be to try and just, like, get rid of all of their stuff because it's just a reminder of the grief, and mm-hmm. try and do their best to just try and move on. And so getting rid of a bunch of stuff might be the best way for some people. I think I'm just bothered by the word junk, referring
yeah.
to the child who you lost and referring to their stuff as junk. Because I think I would have had the opposite reaction, but it's possible that she goes the other way and it's just like, I need to get rid of all this stuff because it's just painful to look at.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think she said that off and on. She said 5 years. She said that for about the past 5 years, off and on, she's been using crack cocaine, which would have been throughout pretty much. I mean, that would have been her children's entire life, both of her pregnancies. So she was, how old was she? She was 26 years old. So she started using about the time she was 20 or 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I noted in one of the articles that her son, LaVon, who was 3 at the time, Christopher's older brother, I guess soon after Christopher went missing, LaVon moved in with his grandma. And so Alliston didn't have Christopher. She didn't have LaVon. And I'm wondering if the reason that LaVon moved in with his grandmother soon after Christopher disappeared was because maybe Alliston started using again. Maybe she was spiraling, which, I mean, if she's going to spiral anytime, I imagine that would be the moment that would
hit
the hardest.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually, her ex-husband, the boy's father, he moved up from Florida and moved back to Harlem. And then LaVon started living with him. Alliston wasn't taking care of any more kids after Christopher disappeared.
Yeah.
Which I want to talk about Alliston and her ex. I actually don't know if they were married. I think he's an ex-husband. If not, he's the boy's father.
Okay.
This might not even be important to the case, but it's something that has been bothering me.
Mm-hmm.
The boy's father is 20 years older than Allison.
That's problematic.
Well, it's just, it's interesting. Like, if he was only a few years older, I wouldn't think twice about it. But when they got together, she would have been... Well, I don't know when they got together, but the time that they had when she got pregnant with her first one, she would have been about 23 years old, and he was 43.
Yeah, that's...
So, yeah, Milton Robbins, who is the boy's father, apparently he was an aircraft mechanic working in Miami at the time that Christopher disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to piece together, like, how he met Allison. Like, how did he end up starting this relationship with a woman 20 years younger, having two children with her, and this whole time she's addicted to crack cocaine? Because as far as I know, he's not addicted to crack cocaine. Maybe he is, but it seems weird that he seems to be successful. He made his way out of Harlem. He got out of a Harlem. It seems like he had a good job.
Is he from Harlem?
Yes.
Okay.
As far as I know, I'm pretty sure they met in Harlem and then they separated and then he got a job in Miami. But what is this man who's 20 years older than her doing having two children with a woman who is addicted to cocaine?
Well, I mean, no offense right off the bat to anybody who's in a relationship where there's a large age gap like that. And I think it matters less and less the older you get. But when it comes to women in their early 20s or younger... in relationships with men who are 20 years their senior, at least, I have some concerns about that because I think that's predatory right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And Allison had LeVon at 23, right?
About
23. So their relationship potentially started before that, which Allison would have been really, really young. Like, your brain isn't even fully developed until you're at least 25. You're still a child.
Like, well, it sounds like she was really vulnerable.
Exactly. So, yeah, that which is my entire point. She was vulnerable in her relationship with this older man. What types of things could he have exposed her to? Or, yeah, and it's not like automatically his fault that she was on drugs, but it does make me wonder what happened.
I wonder if he's the one that introduced her to drugs.
It does make me wonder. Yeah.
Yeah, or was supplying them or something. And yeah, that's just speculation. But I'm trying to figure out their dynamic because I feel like the relationships that are at play here affect who we should, you know, how we should view the case. The other thing is one of the news articles, actually that same news article from Daily News in 1991, there's a big picture. So a couple years after the kidnapping, the news outlets, they re-interviewed the families and they took family pictures and they both obviously look just completely miserable in the pictures. Allison is just completely unfocused. She looks miserable. And then in the picture is Milton, her, you know, ex-partner.
Mm-hmm.
And then their son, LeVon, who's now 4 years old, 4 or 5 years old. And Milton's moved back to Harlem and LeVon's living with him. And LeVon is wearing a crew neck sweatshirt that says, like, University of Miami, which maybe isn't important. But I was like, did Milton go to University of Miami? Like, is he a college-educated aircraft mechanic doing well for himself? Meanwhile, his ex-partner is the one who's struggling with drug use and he left her to raise two children?
Yeah. The fuck's up with that, Milton?
And like, I don't know their story, but like, just from an outside perspective, I was like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
Like, this woman needed help, and I don't think she was getting it.
Yeah.
I think Allison was actually like born and raised in that same housing project.
Okay.
Like, I think she spent her entire life there and was prepared to have her kids spend their entire lives there. Like, I think it was a multi-generational location.
Yeah.
I think because she had several sisters, cousins, and her mom all lived in that same housing project. And I don't know where Milton fits into that, if he was also raised there and he got out, or how they met. I have no idea. Here's the other thing. I have no idea where her name Dansby comes from.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Because her mom and her sisters have the last name Manley, which I assume is her maiden name. And then her children's father has the last name Robbins.
Maybe different fathers, or maybe like Allison's mother just decided to use her name.
The most common thing I see is that children are named after their father.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I assumed that Allison and her kids took some man's name and that the children have their father's last name. But you're saying it's possible that Allison's name actually is Allison Dansby and she gave her children her name. It just doesn't track with the majority.
No, it doesn't. It would be a different case, especially back in the 90s, because I feel like that was extra the norm. Like, you just got your dad's last name. Right now, it's changing more.
The only reason I bring it up is that if it was another partner, like if there's another man in the picture that isn't being brought up, that there's a whole nother person of interest that hasn't been talked about.
That's true.
Because obviously, LaVon and Christopher were Milton's sons. Mm-hmm. But it's possible that Allison had a relationship with a completely different man whose last name was Dansby, who somehow isn't being... I don't even know if there is one.
Yeah, we don't even know.
There's a mysterious ghost man out there, possibly, that I don't know about.
Mysterious ghost man?
Well, he might not be real. He might just exist in my head.
Yeah.
I don't know where the name Dansby comes from.
Yeah. And that's fair. I mean, yeah. Also, I saw that Rosalie was trying to collect a $10,000 life insurance policy for Shane just 12 days before he went missing.
She instated a life insurance policy just 12 days before he went missing.
And my first reaction to that was to be kind of suspicious. But then I...
Don't be suspicious. Yeah.
But then I remembered, like, life insurance policies are basically just loans. Like, you can take out a life insurance policy on somebody and then use it. Like, use the money in it. So
sounds like you know more than I do. I don't know anything about life insurance.
I mean, I just figured this out, like, literally, I think 6 months ago, that you could take out a life insurance policy on yourself or somebody else and use it like a personal loan, because it basically is. So if you wanted to take out money, like, you purchased a $1 million life insurance policy and you're going to pay into it for the rest of your life or whatever. If you needed like $20,000, you could go to your insurance company and say, I'd like to take out $20,000 of that life insurance policy.
I still don't understand. But you could say it probably six ways till Sunday and I'd be like, mm-hmm.
Okay.
Anytime people talk about insurance, I'm just like, okay.
I mean, that's fair, because insurance policies and companies are completely off the wire. Who gave them the power that they have?
I already think they're kind of designed to be a scam. I don't think you're meant to understand them.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
But you're saying...
So it's possible...
Say it one more time. Maybe I can get it.
You can treat life insurance policies as personal loans.
So you can go to an insurance agent and take out money?
Yeah.
And they'll give you cash? They'll give you money?
Yeah. I mean, there's stipulations and rules about it, depending on, like, what kind of life insurance policy you purchase.
And then you have to pay it back?
Yeah. But if you already signed a contract for a life insurance policy, like, you're going to pay into it anyway.
Oh, you're saying you can take it out at any time.
Yeah, you could take it out at any time. Sorry. That's what I was trying to communicate. Like,
I don't think that's what happened here, though, because she was fighting tooth and nail to try and even get the $10,000.
So she instated a life insurance policy on Shane 12 days before he went missing, or she was trying to collect $10,000 on a life insurance policy that was already existed.
She opened up a new policy 12 days before he went missing, and then... According to her, she didn't even try and collect the money until, like, years later.
Oh, okay.
So, like, years later, and she said that she didn't even think to do it, except that her insurance agent reached out to her and said that she might be eligible because he was never found.
Oh.
Because the policy was that if someone is deceased, if the policyholder or whatever, if the person with the policy is deceased, in this case Shane, because it was covering him. But apparently it was kind of a sticky situation because they couldn't prove that he was dead.
Yeah.
But I guess the state laws at that time were that if someone's missing for more than 3 years and there's been a diligent, like a quote-unquote diligent effort to try and find them or recover them, and they're not found, then they can be assumed to be dead.
Yeah.
So she was able to collect that money, but she had to fight for it, and it was like years later.
Okay. That's good.
Just the timing of her taking out the insurance policy is what was suspicious, because people are like, what are the odds that you take out an insurance policy on your child and then they go missing 12 days later?
What an unfortunate coincidence.
Yeah, and some people believe it wasn't a coincidence, that she was just trying to... $10,000 isn't even a lot in the grand scheme.
I don't think... I think it was a coincidence, personally. I think that there's no way they did it. I just can't I don't know. And it's probably because of my own bias. But after watching their interviews and everything, I just don't think they did it.
Well, and that's like how I felt with Debbie Grabber's case. Like, I wholeheartedly was like, the mom couldn't have done it.
Yeah.
And it's probably because I'm biased as a mother that I'm like, oh, I could never
do that to your own child.
Think of doing that to my child, but
people do it.
I don't think everyone shares that same bias. Some people are like, no, the moms are completely capable of harming their children.
Yeah.
And historically they have. And then on top of that, Allison's drug usage, I think a lot of people are like, well, she already wasn't in a stable state of mind. And people who are addicted to drugs will do desperate things.
Yeah, but I mean, Allison still had somewhat of a support system. And so I don't think she would turn to like desperate things. Like there was some speculation that she sold Christopher, right, to pay for drugs. And I think that's seriously outlandish considering she still had like her mom and some siblings in the picture. Like LaVonne and Christopher's dad was still somewhat in the picture. Like people who do that have like nothing and no one and are usually extremely, extremely isolated and desperate.
Here's the other thing we forgot to mention is Rosalie's ex-husband, Shane's father, James, is that his name? Yeah, James.
Yeah.
He would stop by every Thursday, which was payday for him. He worked construction across town, and he would bring them money. And I don't know, it doesn't say anywhere in any of the source documents that I read whether or not he was there that same Thursday that he disappeared, that Shane disappeared.
Weird.
Because Shane disappeared on a Thursday evening, and if James's account is true that he came every Thursday to bring the money, was he there that day that Shane disappeared?
Weird.
Right? And I didn't see in any of Rosalie's interviews whether or not she even mentioned that he had been there that day. If I don't know what time he showed up, but like when I worked construction, at least in my experience, a lot of construction starts, your shift starts very early in the morning, especially like when you work in the city, you get there before like rush hour, right?
Yeah.
A lot of construction sites start at like 5, 6, 7 a.m. And then in that case, if you're working an 8 or a 10-hour shift, you get off usually in the early afternoon, which is really nice.
Yeah.
So that would, you know, put him, whenever I worked construction, I would get off at like 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And so if that's what his schedule was like, did he go to the projects right after he got off work? Was he there at like, you know, 3-4 o'clock, which would have been right before Shane went missing? Or is it that Shane went missing before James had a chance to even come by and bring them the money? It's odd timing that the same day that Shane goes missing, James normally would have been there to bring them part of his paycheck.
A lot of really unfortunate and weird coincidences in this story, which makes it probably even more like WTF worthy because they couldn't find anything. There were dead ends everywhere.
Yeah.
Despite all of these coincidences, despite all of these clashing, intersecting facts that would be suspicious otherwise, or still are, I guess.
The other thing is, depending on which article you read, there's contrasting accounts about the two kids seen at the playground when Shane disappeared.
Yeah.
So Rosalie's account of what happened is that she brought Shane down to the park and they were eating snacks. Some of the accounts say that he was eating a strawberry ice cream. Another one said that he was eating potato chips. I don't know which one is true or both are true, but she and Shane were sitting on the park bench together eating snacks, and a 10-year-old girl and her 5-year-old brother came up to them and asked if they could play with Shane. And those are essentially the kids who were last to see him before he went missing, because they were supposedly playing with him when he disappeared. And depending on what articles you read, some even quote the police as saying that Christopher Dansby was playing with the exact same children.
Really?
Which would be really, really extra suspicious. But then I don't know that it's actually true, because there's other contrasting accounts. Like Allison didn't say that. Her mom didn't say that.
Yeah.
Her mom, Elizabeth, who was watching them, actually said that he was playing ball with his cousin Elton.
Mm-hmm.
And there was absolutely no mention of the 10-year-old girl or the 5-year-old boy. I think some people may have extraneously like inserted them into both stories because they saw so many other similarities.
And it's possible they were there anyway because they lived in that same building. They probably went to that park relatively often. And so they were probably there at the same time, which is, again, an unfortunate coincidence. And I mean, the stuff that I read said that they heavily looked into the families of those children because except Rosalie was so, so dead set that those children had something to do with it.
Rosalie was convinced, and honestly, it was so suspicious
because of that man at the park?
The man at the park was very suspicious. The fact that she didn't know him. He was a complete stranger, which, mm-hmm. honestly, strange men come up and talk at you.
Yeah, unfortunately.
It happens all the time.
Uh-huh.
Where, like, they don't even know you, but they'll just walk up and start telling you their life story.
Yeah.
She said that she had never seen him before. One account describes him as being elderly. I don't know how old that puts him at, but she described him as being older. And that he was specifically talking about, like, gotta keep an eye on your kids because of kidnappings. And that was eerie.
Mm-hmm.
Eerie as f***.
Yep.
Like, can you imagine someone comes up to you and starts talking, like a random man comes up to you while you're watching your children and starts talking about kidnapping?
And then your son gets kidnapped?
And then I would be held, that is so, so suspicious.
I think that's part of the reason why Rosalie went so, like, crazy, not crazy, but, like, she was not okay after Shane disappeared. And I think this is partly why, because she felt like there were signs everywhere and she probably ignored them. At least me inserting myself into her shoes, that's how I would personally feel. Like, oh my God, there were signs everywhere and I didn't see them and it was too late and I could have prevented it. So that she could have, obviously. This is not her fault at all.
Honestly, like, I am also suspicious of the 10-year-old and 5-year-old. I know that they were looked into, but mm-hmm. in my own personal experience, 10-year-olds and 5-year-olds, I guess it's kind of hit or miss whether or not they like playing with littler kids. In my experience, I feel like a lot of older kids... I had a 5-year-old one time come up to me when my son Grimm was a little under 2. I think he was like 18 months, so about Shane's age. And Grimm was trying to play on the playground, and the 5-year-old was like, can you get him out of here? He straight up said that to me. He's like, I'm trying to play on the playground. And I was naughty back. I was like, he's trying to play on the playground. He's like, but he's a baby. He's not supposed to be on here. And I was like, he's just trying to enjoy his day, you little shit.
Can you get him out of here?
Yeah. Straight up, this 5-year-old was just like, I'm trying to play and your baby is getting in my way. And I was like, we were here first.
That's hilarious.
Well, it's hit or miss. Some,
yeah, yeah.
Some older kids, they like playing with babies, and they're like, ooh, a baby. But
can
sometimes
you get him out of here? I'm dead.
I've never had older kids come up to me like, can we play with your baby? Most of the time, they're just like, oh, the stupid baby is in my way.
Yeah. So do you think it's possible that, an adult, like, bribed this 10 and 5-year-old into saying, like, hey, go play with that baby, bring him over here, and I'll give you, like, something in return?
I think it's possible, but I don't know how those kids would have maintained that facade when they were interrogated by police.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it shouldn't be that hard to crack a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old to just be like, hey, did somebody come up to you and offer you something?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're not, I don't know about the laws back then, but, like, right now, you are not allowed to ask any leading questions to children at all.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So that question would be totally leading.
That was probably not
the case.
Yeah. In 1989, I
doubt it.
It was probably more lax than that. They were probably interrogating 2-year-olds until 5 a.m.
Yes. I wouldn't put it past them, but.
No fruit snacks until.
Till you tell me what happened.
Yeah. I think it's hella suspicious.
I agree.
That they walked up and were, like, begging her to play with him right mm-hmm. before he went missing. Because already the begging to play with him is weird.
Yeah.
Especially they begged to play with him and then they abandoned him.
Yeah. And Rosalie did say that it was weird. Like, she felt weird about it. Like, it was not normal. That didn't happen. And she felt like she shouldn't, but that it would be rude or unreasonable not to.
She tried to tell the kids, like, no, like, she
he's
tried
really
to say
little.
No at first.
Yeah.
She was like, he's really little, because 19 months old, you still
he's
have to heavily
tiny.
Watch them,
yeah.
because they'll still try to, like, fall off of things.
Depth perception, like, isn't 100 yet.
My daughter, who, she's 17 months, almost 18, so a little bit younger than him, like, she was on a playground a couple days ago, and she saw a puppy, and she tried to walk right off of the playground to get to it.
What?
Like, they're completely, like, maybe my kids are just stupid, but they're not as keenly aware of, like, when guardrails aren't there.
I think,
like,
that's
they'll
just
see
all
something
kids.
And then they'll react instinctively and they'll just, like, walk off of stuff or fall off of stuff. So, like, if a 10-year-old was like, hey, can we play with Faye? I would be like, okay, but you have to really watch her,
because
she might just, like, seriously land on her head.
Yeah.
Like, she can't go down the slide by herself. You have to hold her.
Yeah.
And go, whee!
She could yeet herself off the side or something, like...
Yeah, and Shane was probably around the same developmental stage where you probably had to hold him...
To do most of the things you do at the playground.
This kid is still in diapers.
Yeah.
Like, he's still very much a baby.
Yeah, so
Which is another thing. Whoever kidnapped him, like, when Elton was at school... I think it was Elton was at the school the next day on Friday.
Yeah.
And he told his principal that he saw a strange man walking Christopher down the street and was holding him. And he said that Christopher was still in the same clothes that he was wearing the day before.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if that was Elton just being a little kid and he imagined it, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah. He saw another baby. And
if you kidnap a kid who is, like, under the age of 3, the chances are they're going to have, like, their diaper changed and, like, somebody has to be taking care of them.
Well, who would take that baby out in public?
I don't know. It's just whoever took him.
In the same clothes.
Yeah, they didn't have a change of clothes for him. That whole sighting, I think, is odd to me. I'm not entirely sure if I believe it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, I mean, 7-year-olds... I don't know. I haven't spent enough time with 7-year-olds to know if, like, they're really trustworthy to be like, yes, I saw this, and this is the man that was holding him.
Because I believe Elton, but I also don't know if that's 100% what he saw. I believe he thinks he saw that, but it could have been, like, the baby had the same outfit, like, if it was bought at like, a box store, like, Target or something, like... I don't know if Target was a thing back then. Yeah, it probably was.
Yeah, it was.
Like, if it was the same outfit bought at Target and multiple babies had that same outfit. Like, what if he saw a different baby, but it was in the same clothing?
But it was
right?
His cousin. I feel like his cousin would be able to recognize his own cousin.
How far away did he say it was? Like, for the sighting?
So, the school isn't that far away. It's just, like, around the corner. It's, like, one street. It's, like, a block away.
But did Elton, like, see them from across the street, like, right in front of him, walk right in front of him, or, like...
I think it was across the street. Like, he looked out his classroom window and saw a strange man that he didn't recognize who had Christopher by the hand and was walking him. The reason that I have trouble believing it is, in addition to Elton being young, being 7 years old, which you have to take with a grain of salt, it's odd to me that a kidnapper would take his victim just out on a stroll in broad daylight, a block away from where he kidnapped him from, and didn't even try and disguise that it maybe was a different child, that he was in the same clothes. So part of me thinks that Elton maybe was confused, maybe he imagined it, maybe he was just really distraught because being
I'm sure this was traumatic, like, for the whole community.
And so... It's possible that he just, it was a bad daydream or something, but I think part of it is that if Elton saw Christopher wearing the same outfit, it also could be that Elton, being as young as he was, just was repeating, like, he didn't have the wherewithal to make up seeing Christopher in a different outfit.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Where the police were like, what was he wearing? And he was just like,
the same clothes?
And then just described, what he had seen when he was playing with him the day before. He could have just had, like, PTSD.
Yeah.
Because he was the last one to be playing with him.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine your cousin gets kidnapped and your family is distraught. Your aunts and your grandma are all crying and they're upset and they miss him. And they're probably trying to milk him for information. That kid was probably getting, like, shaken by the shoulders. Like, where did he go? What were you doing?
Imagine being interrogated by your whole family and the police. About that.
Elton was probably heavily interrogated and probably traumatized.
Oh, I'm
sure. Probably felt responsible. Like, I was the last one playing with him and now he's gone and he's probably racking his brain and not sleeping and I don't know. So part of me wonders if his sighting was just...
A trauma response?
Yeah, maybe. But for argument's sake, if it was true, it's really wild to me that a kidnapper would just be as bold as that and just, like, take the kid out for a stroll. Like, he just needs his daily vitamin D.
If it is true, that makes me think that whoever kidnapped him was mentally ill. Like the police had a theory that it was, like, must have been a woman who recently lost a child and was trying to rectify this by stealing someone else's baby. Like,
oh, yeah. So the two major theories that I saw printed in the news by police, their two major theories were that, like, the criminal profile that they put out and assigned to this case is that it was either a man who is involved in, like, a baby selling ring who most likely does drugs, or was a woman who recently lost a child to either you know, accident, death, mishap, or had her child taken away and put in foster care. And it could be both. It could be a man kidnapping a baby and then selling it to a woman or giving it to a woman who's recently lost a child.
Yeah.
But those were the kind of suspects that they were looking for.
Mm-hmm. So if Elton was telling the truth and he really did see that and it really did happen, that makes me think it was more likely that. But yeah, very strange scenario.
Yeah.
But even then, we have literally nothing. We have all of this information and literally nothing, which is so, so frustrating. And I'm sure it's heart-wrenching and, like, soul-eating for the mothers who experienced this tragedy.
Yeah. And then, what was I going to say? I lost my train of thought. Oh, what I was going to say is that in a lot of the cases that we study, whenever there's, like, no evidence or very little evidence, it seems like a lot of times we can trace it back to police fault. Or police negligence, where yeah. It's like, they probably could have gotten better or more evidence if the police had just taken it more seriously or listened to the victim.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it's weird because if you talk to the mothers or hear the mother's side of the story, both of them will say, like, no, the police were on top of it. Like,
mm-hmm. I was really surprised to hear that the police did, like, a crazy search and they interviewed everyone in the building multiple times. And, like, it seems like they really did their due diligence yeah. for this case.
They went through all 1,800 apartments. Three different times.
Mm-hmm.
The first time, like, immediately that night, right? So they had to eventually go to bed, and they came back the next day, and they had bloodhounds, they had helicopters, they had all of the maintenance workers at the complex, like, digging through dumpsters. We never talked about also the bloodhound.
Yeah.
If you look in the newspaper, there's a picture of, like, an officer. He's got this big wrinkly bloodhound. I love bloodhounds. He's got this big old wrinkly bloodhound, and the bloodhound's name is Cracker.
Cracker.
Like, I don't know why that's so funny.
Accurate.
Yeah, exactly. Cracker, he's such a good boy. Cracker was able to trace Christopher's scent, I guess, like a block or two, and then it just disappeared. So
which is
they think
so
that
weird. He got in a
they
car.
Think that maybe, like, that's the biggest evidence we have that he even, you know, went anywhere
yeah.
or that he even existed in the first place.
Yeah.
Is that they tracked his scent for, like, a couple blocks to 111th Street, and then it disappeared. So he, you know, maybe got into a car or something, which also doesn't help Elton's sighting of him, because according to Elton, he was just around the corner. But according to the bloodhound, his scent went for a couple blocks and then disappeared, meaning he probably was taken somewhere further away.
Yeah.
I just feel like if you're going to kidnap a child and you're going to have, you know, 70 police officers and helicopters and bloodhounds, you know, storming the entire, I don't even know, radius, your best bet if you don't want to get caught is to take the child very far away.
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to kidnap someone, you need to take them, put them in a car and take them very far away so that you're nowhere near the initial crime scene.
And according to the information we have, yeah, like Philadelphia, just like the psychic thought. So yeah, all in all, I was pleasantly surprised at the police response to this. Sad that they didn't find anything. There's nothing else that could be done.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's a bizarre case, and there's a reason why it's run cold this long, because whoever kidnapped these kids or whatever happened, they did a very good job of not leaving any evidence.
Yeah.
And they didn't leave a clear motive, because
kind of like whoever did this maybe had done it a lot before, professionals at it.
It's possible. But if they did, according to the statistics, there were no other kids' disappearances who really fit this MO in like a 10-year period, though.
I imagine, okay, this might sound like crazy conspiracy theorist, I guess, but I imagine that if you're kidnapping kids and you're professional, like this is what you do, you mm-hmm. probably only hit a few areas over and over. Like you don't go back to certain areas for a specific amount of time at least because of that. So if you're going to different cities, different states, and you're snatching kids all over, it looks unrelated. And it can separate you from like linking cases together and seeing similarities and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, so it could have been like a larger network of kidnappings across, you're thinking it could be across state lines.
Yeah.
Whoever kidnapped Christopher and Shane, I don't think it would be a white person. I think it would have to be somebody who fit in with their surroundings to be able to be this stealthy. And so, and also, like, the police were essentially saying that it was most likely a black man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the type of man that Elton saw holding Christopher's hand.
Yeah.
Was a black man. And so, like, yeah, there was such a minority population in Harlem. It was mostly, I think they said, like, black and Hispanic. And then the area used to be heavily Italian.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of narrows down the kind of person that you're most likely looking for. Because if you're a white person in Harlem and you're stealing babies, people would find you so fast.
Yeah. You would stick out. So it would probably be somebody who's blends in well, flies under the radar.
That's my theory anyways. It wouldn't make sense. Like, can you imagine just some, like, middle-aged white ladies stealing kids? They would be like, yeah, that's Kaylee. She's the middle-aged white lady baby snatcher. Yeah, they're stealing kids.
Like a sore thumb sticking out.
That's like, well, because, like, just in my personal experience, like, if you've ever been to areas where you're the minority, you're not going to pull anything. You're not going to do anything weird because you're like, I stick out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. Yep.
It's like one of my old coworkers, he's white. He's very white. And he's married to a black woman and they live in an all black neighborhood. And he said that, and he gets along with all of his neighbors really well, but it's kind of a long-running joke that they use him as a point of reference. So if someone asks, like, oh, how do I get to this location? They're like, okay, go north and then turn left at white guy's house.
I'm dead. Hilarious.
Because he's, like, the white guy, and everyone knows him as the white guy, and so they use him as, like, a monument. Like, everyone knows where the white guy lives.
That's
so
fair.
Like, oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's
but, like,
fair.
But when you stick out like
rad.
That and everyone knows who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Like.
Yep. Yeah, so that's a good point.
Yeah. Most crimes, the majority of crimes, intimate crimes like this, kidnappings, murders, things like that, are usually committed within the person's same race.
Yeah.
It doesn't, even knowing that though, it doesn't get us any closer to,
nope.
to who could have done that.
We're still at square one, which is jack shit, unfortunately.
Yeah. Oh, but our listeners can still help though.
Yes. Okay. So police and the families believe Christopher and Shane could have been kidnapped and sold to a new family. If you or anyone you know may have been adopted around 1889. If you or anyone you know...
That sounds like my cousin. He's like 500 years old. Just kidding.
Concern intensifies.
That person would stick out like a sore thumb. Like, that sounds like my cousin who's also my great-great-grandpa.
That's just Zombie Bob wandering around. Zombie Bob.
How come we never thought about this before? Dude was born in like 1850.
God. Okay, I'm going to start all the way over just because I need to. Police and the families believe Christopher and Shane could have been kidnapped and sold to a new family. If you or anyone you know may have been adopted around 1989 and fit either of the boys' description, don't hesitate to call the New York City Police Department Missing Persons Unit at 212-694-7781. Christopher Dansby has a birthmark shaped like a figure eight on his neck, and Shane Walker has a small scar under his chin and a birthmark on the back of his right shoulder that looks like a liver. Be sure to find Crime Suit Podcast on social media and let us know your thoughts and theories. You can follow us on TikTok at Crime Suit Podcast and on Instagram and Twitter at crime_soup. As always, we'll see you next Tuesday for your next helping of delicious crime soup. Bon appetit!